Welcome to Bio, a podcast produced by the Biographers International Organization. Bio is devoted to promoting the work of biographers and advocating for biography as a genre with the support of biographers and biography lovers worldwide. I'm Bio member Lisa Napoli. On each episode, we'll talk with a biographer about his or her work. If you've read the New York Times at any point over the last 20 years, you've probably seen Adam Nagorny's byline. About 7 years ago, he decided to assign himself a different challenge, to pick up where Gay Talese left off with his acclaimed book, The Kingdom and the Power, and write a contemporary history of the times. I asked Nagorny how he decided to write a biography of his employer.
Yeah, I was trying to write an in-depth narrative history of the New York Times starting in 1977, going through 2016, and relying almost entirely on firsthand sources, on interviews with principals when they were alive, on archives, on personal papers. And it took 7 years, but it was very rewarding.
And when you went into it, and as any of us go into it when we write any sort of book, but in your case, this is a biography of a place that involves hundreds of people, really. You probably, I assume, and I kind of know from having talked to you about this a little bit before, that you didn't really understand what you were stepping into in terms of the research. You understood the history. You understood the players.
Oh, yeah.
But let's talk a little bit about that wall that we all run into, or the iceberg that we encounter. And in your case, it was magnified because it was so many different people's stories that had to come together to tell one bigger story. What were some of the obstacles you came up against or insights that you learned about early on?
Oh, I mean, the first thing I wanted to do was to interview key players. And I went to the publisher at the time, Arthur Oxholzberger Jr., and asked him whether or not he would cooperate with this project if I did it. It's not an authorized book in any way. And he said he'd get back to me. I think he got back to me a month later, and he said, yes, I will sit down with you and do as many interviews as you want. I'm not going to tell anyone else what to do. You're on your own. And what I did not realize, though, and I should have, is that once the publisher said he was going to talk to me, everyone else did. I mean, maybe one or two people did, but basically everyone else did. And in approaching it, I just made a very, very long list of the people who I thought, and obviously it's an evolving story as I was finding stuff out, that I thought I needed to talk to. And the first thing I did was to begin to talk to people who were older, which would include the retired executive editors and the publisher, because, I mean, for obvious reasons, right? Because you don't want to lose them either to death or early decline. And I was lucky that way, because one of the executive editors is, I think, had a stroke since, and I spoke to him beforehand. But what that meant, though, is that I was going in and interviewing people before I knew everything I wanted to talk about or know. And I'd be asking about stuff I didn't know about and throwing out some open questions. And I go into every interview with a completely open mind, trying to learn stuff, but I don't want to go in as a dummy. And there were cases where, you know, I found myself doing that just because that's what you need to do with the older sort of generation. And then after that, I kind of followed it where it went. You know, I was sort of figuring out along the way episodes that I want to write about. For example, the fabrication/plagiarism scandal involving a young reporter named Jason Blair. So I knew I wanted to talk to Jason, and I knew I wanted to talk to all the editors who dealt with him. But I also knew that I wanted primary documents. In other words, I mean, I trust people to be basically honest, but I don't want to trust their memories. And not only because your memories can be distorted with time, because people often remember stuff in the best light for them, or block bad stuff, or just mix stuff up. I mean, it just happens. So in the course of interviewing one person, he told me that he had Jason Blair's personnel file from the time, all the documents, all the memos that were going back and forth that led to dismissal, and the paper's horrifying recognition of how bad the scandal was. And that, I realized, would be key to telling this story. And this person who offered it to me said, I have just one condition. I need to make sure that Jason agrees to you getting it and using it So there's no lawsuit. I don't know if there would have been a lawsuit or not, Lisa, but there might have been. So I called Jason, and Jason, I had interviewed him at that point, and we had a good relationship, and he was like, go for it. He sent me a note saying it's absolutely fine. So that was really pretty crucial. The other thing, you asked, I don't want to keep babbling on here.
No,
Sorry.
not at all. No, and then there's you might have just been going there right now, the monumental archive at the New York Public Library.
That's right. So I made a point of early on, well, two things. I first went to the New York Public Library, where there is an extensive collection of papers from executives, editors, and various people at the New York Times. When I say extensive, I mean like I don't think I could have gotten through the whole thing in 2 years. And most of it, the vast majority of it is open. And I just spent day after day going through this material, classified by people, events, newsrooms. I didn't go after everything. Like I knew this was going to be a book about the newsroom rather than the business side. So I didn't go as thoroughly through the business archives. But for everyone else, for all the executive editors who had papers there and the general correspondents, I literally went through every document. Like these are well cataloged. The New York Public Library is an excellent resource and documents are cataloged. But you learn stuff just by going through documents. And I would just go through pile after pile of stuff. I took my phone and I had an app that let me called ScanDisk that let me make PDFs of them. And I make PDFs of them as a way of keeping them. Parenthetically, when I first started, I tried to take notes of what I was seeing. And then I realized, no, because I'm not going to really know what I want from these documents when it comes down to write. So I began taking PDFs of them. I put them on my laptop and I was able to create my own kind of database because I would sort of name them with the key figures or ideas in the document so I could search for anything. But by the end of the project, I could find out stuff I had long ago forgotten. So that was the first part. But then there were scattered papers in other places. Max Frankel, for example, one of the executive editors, had donated his personal papers to Columbia University. The other thing was that the newspaper, The Times, stopped the mandatory archival program in, I think, 1992. My belief it was to save money, right? But I don't really know that for sure, but I'm sure I'm right. So I began asking everyone who was, key players through that period if they would give me their papers. And journalists, as you of all people know, tend to save stuff. So people would give me boxes and boxes and boxes of raw documents that they have at it. And I just think that was critical to the way this book came out. Those kind of documents and contemporary back and forth diaries and everything like that.
Oh, yes. In fact, I've complimented you publicly about this before, but the chapter alone about 9/11 and how you recreate that day, or that morning, even forget the rest of it, is just so, it's stunning. And it's as if you were actually in each person's head. So it's a remarkable achievement. I mean, let's talk for a second about the whole idea of you're a reporter through and through for decades now. And here you are, really being a historian as much as you are a reporter. How do you square those two sides of yourself? Or did they just integrate perfectly at this moment in time? I mean, obviously, you were the person meant to write this book. It just, and you were the person crazy enough to want to write this book because it's such a huge, monumental undertaking. But how do you square up that reporter, Adam, and newly anointed historian?
That's a really good question, and I was very, very conscious of it. I wrote another book back in, I think, 1996 on the history of the modern gay political movement, and I was very aware of the criticism of the time, which I thought was legitimate. I was writing it with a colleague named Dudley Plantagenet, that we were reporters and not trained historians, and people, I think, criticized to some extent that a book for that kind of lacking. I was more aware of that, deferential of that, aware of what I was and what I was not, trying to learn. I am not a trained historian. A historian is a really expert kind of profession in this country. I don't want to pass myself off as one. But I was also very aware that I was holding this to a level of standards that I don't think you do at a newspaper only because you don't have time, right? I mean, I have 7 years to go over stuff again and again and again. And I was very, very aware of trying to use only primary sources. again, I would never call myself a historian. I'm not trained that way. It would be presumptuous to me, but I was trying to operate that way. And when you go through the end notes of the book, you'll see a couple of citations from newspaper stories, but basically everything is from documents and from interviews. And I guess in some ways that's what differentiates it from journalism. But journalism is a much quicker thing. I mean, you're doing lots of interviews and, you know, long term stuff. You're also drawing on documents, but this is just a whole level of depth that I think is really more difficult to accomplish when you're writing a newspaper story or even a magazine story.
Right. The time is just not working with you. And plus, also, if we could talk a little bit about the time you need when you're writing something like this for stuff, for lack of a better word, to gel and for you to really have that perspective. I mean, if you wrote the book you wrote in 1996 today, you probably would do it differently just having done this book, I would think.
Absolutely. Starting with the fact that I would have been, you know, I did the same thing on interviews, me and Dudley and I, on interviews, but I would have been much more aggressive in going after archives and understanding why it's so important to get those sorts of documents. I don't think I appreciated that at the time. So I would have been much more aggressive in doing that. And in this book, I tried to, I mean, I think there's very clear conclusions about what happened with the paper and why it succeeded and where it failed. And the highs and lows of the people that I write about, I don't think it's, I mean, let other people judge. I don't think it's judgmental. I don't think it, it doesn't have kind of an edge or an attitude toward it. I mean, I want it to be driven by the research and the reporting and what I learned, hopefully, and I stress hopefully, making myself something of an expert, hopefully, I hate to use this a million ways, on this period in time's history. I want to be able to tell the story without, like, banging people over the head with it. And I think research is the way to do it.
Right. And you are being humble, which is very charming and polite, and your mother would be proud of you. But I think that or maybe she wouldn't be, she'd want you to brag about this, I'm sure. But the truth is that, you know, it is a very difficult thing to pull off what you pulled off, particularly since you have actually been working at this place in many ways.
Oh, yeah.
And, you know, people listening to this may be writing family biographies or memoirs. And those are tricky nuts to crack, as opposed to any other sort of tricky writing nut to crack, in that you were part of this world. And you had to obviously have in your mind that you not only wanted to honor the subject as you would any subject you chose, but also because you had to keep living with that subject and all those people around you. And can you just talk a little bit about that, how people have come to you in the aftermath about their reactions to what you've done?
Yeah, so one thing, that was a huge obstacle or challenge. And the decision was whether or not to leave the paper to do this. I could argue it both ways. I ended up not leaving. What I did do is I ended the book in 2016 with a long epilogue afterwards. And as a result, I am writing almost exclusively, I think with two exceptions, about people who are long gone. It's a history. So I didn't need to go back and rejoin the newsroom after my leave of absence and, you know, run into someone who I'd written about critically or not in the book, or an episode that someone was involved with. There's some exceptions to that, but it made it much less uncomfortable. I'm not sure it would have been tenable. Like, for example, a lot of stuff has happened since 2016. I personally think it's too soon to really write about it in a smart way, but I don't imagine how I could have written about it and gone back to work and found myself working next to or for people who I had just written about. I had a way out in that I was able to prescribe the sort of boundary lines of what I was writing about in a way that minimized, at least not eliminated, just minimized the complications that come with writing about a place you work. The other side of this, I'm not sure whether or not this is relevant to your listeners here, but I think that I brought a certain understanding, expertise, and knowledge of many of the people I was reaching out to that helped with the book. I think that one of the reasons I was able to get access to so many people and get them to at least trust me to talk to me or share documents is because they either knew me or knew of me or watched my career at the paper over the years. But again, I've had other people say to me like, oh, you should have left the paper and done it as an outsider the way Gay Talese did. And he did the original book on this back in the 60s. And I get that. I just didn't do that. I think I made it work without doing that. But again, I'm going to leave that to the readers.
Well, it's so hard to imagine that somebody who wasn't as aware of the paper's history, I can't imagine anyone else having written this book, but it's hard to imagine that somebody could even think about writing this book who didn't have some sort of insider knowledge of the place. And that's, I'm sure we could get all sorts of people who would argue with us. And this is the modern question, right? Is do we have to be something to write about something or someone to write about them? But in this case,
Oh
you
yeah.
know, right? You know, who gets to write the story?
Yeah, I get the question. I know I actually would not, without getting into some of the other aspects of what you're asking about, I think that you could write it as an outsider. I think it would take longer, frankly. I think it would have taken me another, I'm just guessing, another 3 years, actually. I mean, if my publisher's listening, they'd probably blanch at that. And I would have brought some outside perspective that might have in some ways been better. There would have been a distance to the story I was telling that I would never have been able to quite break through. But, you know, we'll never know, you know. Maybe my next book will be about something I'm not part of.
And then somebody 20 years from now will pick up the mantle at the point at which you stopped and go on with the story. Who knows who that will be, where they'll come from. So, what would you do next differently? It's hard to know if you're not, are
Oh.
you, you're not working on another book yet, are you?
No, I'm just obsessing about what it should be. Is it too soon? Somebody told me it's too soon. It's like I'm always thinking
It's
ahead.
sort of like when the puppy dies, you know, do
I
you wait or do you go the next day to the shelter? Everybody's
know.
different, Adam. We're all different. I've obsessed as soon as the book came out about what was next, and it turns out not to be what I ended up doing. So whatever gets you through the night, right? Because you must have so much more time. You must feel like a completely free human now that you have this
I
off your
do, you know,
chest.
I'm back to covering national politics, presidential politics at the time. So I don't have quite as much time, but you know, the book, again, as you know from your experience, it's morning to night. That's all you think about. So that's like, is a big hole, even with doing all my newspaper work. So yeah, I'm definitely looking for something. I have a friend, by the way, who bought a dog before their dog died. I don't mean to laugh, just so they were ready when their dog died.
Right, that's another permutation. I have heard that too. I understand it. But you were too busy covering politics while you, I mean, I can't remember your leave situation. You didn't know, no one ever knows how long these books will take, but you went into this and you took several select leaves along the way.
Yeah. So I went into this, and for the first, I think, 3 years when I was doing research, I was able to manage doing research, interviews, archival work with doing a newspaper job because I don't think you need to be 100% involved in research the way you have to be in writing, just speaking for myself. And then when it came down, I didn't want to like spend the morning writing a chapter and then the afternoon writing a story about, you know, Barack Obama or whoever. I mean, so I had two leaves. One was a year and a half, and the other was a half a year. In the middle of it, I came back to help out during the pandemic on the 2020 presidential campaign. There was no travel. I did that from my office. And then I came back for a year and a half to be the paper's cultural reporter. During that period, I was doing the final touches on the book, the editing, you know, all that stuff that you have to do. So that was manageable. And then I just began, after the book came out, being national political reporter.
Wow. I look forward to seeing what you cook up next as you make your way through the next year, which is not going to be easy. Well, I don't know. What's
No.
harder, covering a presidential campaign or writing a definitive biography of the most important newspaper in the world? I don't know.
I think the latter, but I also think the latter is probably more satisfying in this era that we're in. I mean, we don't talk about politics here, but like politics is extremely important. It's not as fun to write about as it once was, but that's for another podcast. But the book was, I was hanging out with somebody the other night that said that they hated writing, and anyone who tells you they don't is lying. And I thought, you know, like I didn't like it all the time, obviously. But when you're in a groove, when things are really moving and you know you got it right, I love it, you know? And I realize there's a lot of pain to get to that point, but you know what I'm talking about. When you all of a sudden reach that level, when you look at the chapter and you just go, wow, I mean, that took like 3 months, but I got it. And I love that. So
It's a thrill. You
it's a
pieced all
thrill.
those puzzle pieces together, and wow, yeah, you can go like take a nap now, right? Or
Yeah,
something.
exactly. Exactly.
Well, it's so great to talk with you. I'm really grateful for your time and
Sure.
congratulations. again.
Okay. Well, thank you very much. Thanks for your time on this. I really, and all your help on this. I really am grateful.
It's my pleasure. And I think this is really, this will be helpful for the listeners. Thanks, dear. Bye.
Bye-bye.
That's Adam Nagorny, author of The Times, How the Newspaper of Records Survived Scandal, Scorn, and the Transformation of Journalism, published by Penguin Random House in September 2023. We spoke via Zoom on December 18th, 2023. To learn more about Bio or to hear other episodes in our podcast series, please visit our website, biographersinternational.org. I'm Bio member Lisa Napoli in Los Angeles. Alani Hodge created our theme music. Until next time, thanks for listening and have a great day.